Hear ye, hear ye, hear ye. The Supreme Court of the State of South Dakota, the Honorable David Gilbertson presiding, is now open for the transaction of any business that may legally come before it.
Good morning. The first case for oral argument this morning is James Tosler, appellant, versus James and Rosemary Sell, appellees. For the appellant, we have Ms. Sheila Woodward from Yankton, South Dakota, who represents the Sells. And for the appellee, we have Mr. Wally Eckman, an attorney from Gregory, South Dakota. Ms. Woodward, you may proceed. You have 20 minutes.
Please, the court, counsel. Just a minor correction, Your Honor. I represent the defendant, James Tosler, who is the appellant in this case.
Oh, thank you for correcting me. That's the hardest part of my job is getting the parties and the attorneys correctly identified, and then it's all downhill from there.
I have trouble with appellants and appellees. So I'm here today on behalf of Mr. Tosler, challenging a jury's verdict that was entered against him on the plaintiff's claims of tortious interference and civil conspiracy. And I fully recognize that jury verdicts are entitled to deference in this state, but our issues in this case actually relate largely to whether these questions had a legally sufficient basis to be submitted to the jury in the first place. We don't believe there was, as a matter of law, enough evidence to submit either the tortious interference or the civil conspiracy claim to the jury. For that matter, to submit punitive damages to the jury either. On the tortious interference claim, the key to that tort is that it is an intentional tort. And one of the key elements that any person trying to prove a tortious interference claim has to show is that the defendant committed an intentional and improper act of interference. And we now believe there is legally sufficient basis to show that any of my client's conduct, Mr. Tosler's conduct here, were intentional and improper. And that's largely based on the undisputed testimony of attorney Don Molstead, who was Mr. Tosler's attorney throughout the underlying business transactions and who testified unrefuted at trial. The plaintiff alleges that my client improperly interfered in a variety of ways, including buying his brother's equipment and using that equipment in his trailer distribution business, having his brother Frank help him out in his trailer distribution business, and also going to a company called Triton Manufacturing, which is a big trailer manufacturer, and having Frank assist my client in getting a Triton distributorship. But if you look at the evidence and the testimony that was given by Mr. Molstead in this case, my client did not undertake any of those actions.
Trial court err here in anything that it did as far as instructions or allowing or not allowing evidence, or are you just simply saying the jury is wrong?
I'm simply saying the trial court erred in submitting this case to the jury in the first place because there was not a legally sufficient basis to submit the tortious interference claim to the jury.
So you have no problems with instructions or anything like that?
Other than the punitive damages instructions, we didn't object to any of the instructions.
There was something unusual in the instructions, I see. The court actually gave a summary of the facts in the case to the jury. And I hadn't seen that before in South Dakota courts. But there was no objection. Trial counsel at that did not object to that summary of facts either?
I don't believe so, Your Honor.
So we are kind of stuck with those facts then, aren't we?
Well, I don't know that you're stuck with those facts and that they still had to prove, I mean, the plaintiff still had the burden of proving that those facts
right.
existed. There's a case out of the Wisconsin Court of Appeals called Breezemaster, and that's a situation that involved a tortious interference case, just like this, where an individual was alleged to have tortiously interfered with a contract. And in that case, that individual had consulted with their attorney and had gotten legal advice on what they could and couldn't do before they took any of the actions that were alleged to interfere with the contract. And the Wisconsin Court of Appeals held as a matter of law that when you've got good faith reliance on an attorney's legal opinion that your conduct is not improper, you cannot be held to have intentionally and improperly interfered with the contract. The Nebraska court, I'm sorry.
I was just going to say that, isn't that just one factor to consider? It isn't a silver bullet. If you get a lawyer to say it's okay, you're done.
The Wisconsin Court of Appeals held that it was, that as a matter of law meant that you could not meet that third prong of the tortious interference test, that it's an improper as a matter of law. Now, I agree with you, Your Honor, that if you gave a lawyer a third of the facts and didn't tell the whole truth and, you know, we're shading things just to try hide behind a lawyer's opinion, that's not going to go very far. But that's not the case here, and not the case in the Wisconsin Court of Appeals case either. The Nebraska Supreme Court went even further on this prong. That was a case, it's called Aon Consulting. And in that case, an employer was going to hire an employee that had a non-compete agreement. The employee told the employer, I've talked to my lawyer. The lawyer told me that non-compete agreement is not enforceable. So the employer, in reliance on that information from the employee, hired the employee. When that employer was later sued for tortious interference with the non-compete agreement, the Nebraska Supreme Court said, hey, the employee told you that their lawyer said that was a valid, or it was an invalid non-compete, you're entitled to rely on that. So your conduct's not improper.
But we're not looking just at a non-compete agreement. We have faxes, we have use of company forms, we have facts that had nothing to do with the attorney that the jury could look at as well here, don't we?
I actually think those facts had to do with Mr. Molstead. Before Jim Tozier took any action, when his brother's company was going under, he went and talked to Mr. Molstead, and he said, what can I do here? Mr. Molstead said undisputedly that both Jim Tozier, my client, and his brother Frank were very concerned about making sure that what they did was arm's length and complied with business standards. So he went and talked to Mr. Molstead before he took Frank into the business and had Frank helping him out in the business.
Well, I understand that, but what I'm saying is, you know, as I understand the record, there's some evidence that the staff was told not to tell customers, you know, why this changeover happened. There were faxes sent with Frank's name on them. Frank apparently obtained some licenses in other states. There's things that are unrelated to the attorney.
Well, I don't think those are unrelated to the attorney. When Jim asked Mr. Molstead if Frank could participate in the business and help him out in the transition process, Mr. Molstead said yes.
Well, are you saying the trial evidence is that Mr. Molstead approved every single one of these facts?
I'm not saying that. I would say that I don't think the fact that Frank Tozier signed a document proves that Jim Tozier interfered with Mr. Seal's contract. I would say that's an irrelevant fact from the tortious interference case. Might have something to do with the civil conspiracy case, I guess, but it doesn't have anything to do with the tortious interference with the contract. I agree, Mr. Molstead didn't sit there and approve every letter and every contract, but if you look at what he did approve and what he did direct my client to do, as far as making sure he bought the equipment at an arm's length from a third party, that he told my client that it was okay to go and take Frank and talk to Triton about potentially having Jim get the Triton franchise. He told my client that it would be okay to have Frank help him out in the transition in the business. So the main facts that seem to support this tortious interference claim were all run past an attorney before they ever were done by my client.
I guess that points out the point I'm trying to make. You just said the main facts support that, but there are other facts. And so why shouldn't the jury have made the decision?
I don't think those other facts, the facts here and there, a license application, I don't see how those facts prove that Jim Tozier tortiously interfered intentionally and improperly with the contract. I don't think those facts are relevant to the tortious interference case, and I certainly don't think they form a legally sufficient evidentiary basis to have submitted that case to the jury. Perhaps the bigger problem with the tortious interference case, though, is the causation of damages. My understanding of the plaintiff's theory here is that my client's alleged interference with the Triton distribution agreement that Frank had caused Frank not to pay them what he owed them. And all the jury did in this case was simply say, all right, Frank didn't pay the plaintiffs, so Jim, you need to. And I don't see how we got from step A, Frank not paying the seals, to my client being forced to pay it, because there's a big gap between those two things as far as proximate causation is concerned. There's no evidence whatsoever that Frank could have paid the seals back but for my client's obtaining of the Triton franchise. None. No evidence. When Frank filed bankruptcy, he owed CIT Lending, which is the first secured party in this case, $262,000. He owed my client $200,000, and he owed the seals $104,000. And CIT Lending had a priority security interest in all of Frank's collateral, all of it, as a matter of law. CIT had a security interest. So CIT had to be paid before the seals were ever going to be paid. So there is no evidence here that had my client not come in and run this trailer distribution business for 7 months, that Frank could have paid CIT Lending the $262,000 they needed to be paid before the seals could get paid. I don't know that either CIT or the seals had a security interest in the Triton franchise. That franchise agreement was a verbal agreement, nothing in writing. It was terminable at will by Triton. Mr. Seal admitted it in his testimony that franchise had no independent value. Mr. Eklund said in his opening argument that franchise was not something that you could put a price on and sell. A debtor has to have rights in the collateral before a security agreement can attach to it. And I don't think that as a matter of law that Frank ever had an attachable security interest in the agreement with Triton.
Well, whether there was a security interest that could be, whether there was an interest that could be secured, by security interest doesn't have anything to do with whether or not the note should have been repaid. Whether the note's secured or unsecured, it doesn't matter. You're still entitled contractually.
It does matter for the tortious interference case, though, Your Honor, because the claim that the plaintiff is making is that my client interfered with their collateral. And had my client not come in and interfered with their collateral that they were rightly entitled to, this Triton agreement and anything else, that's where the interference occurred. So, yes, it makes a big difference in this case because the collateral is what was allegedly interfered with by my client.
I thought it was the business relationship. I thought the allegation was that there was tortious interference with business relationship. Not a narrow taking of a particular piece of collateral.
My understanding, and if you look at the opening arguments by the plaintiff, the agreement that my client allegedly interfered with was the contract between the plaintiffs and my client's brother, Frank, for the sale of that business. That's the agreement. And that's where the collateral is. They're claiming that my client looted the collateral from this business, took everything out of this business. And that's how he allegedly interfered with this agreement between the plaintiffs and his brother, because he got in there and took out the collateral, looted it, left nothing there for anyone. So I believe that the collateral is the key issue as to what was interfered with in this case.
Of course, there's no dispute of fact that they did get the Triton franchise.
That's true.
So he did get that whatever it's worth.
He got that 14 months after Frank stopped paying the seals, yes.
Were the facts that was later transferred to the seal's daughter?
Right.
And when did that happen?
My client got the franchise on July 1st, 2006, And roughly 4 months later, he got a letter from Triton saying, you're done. You're not going to work with us anymore. We'll give you 3 months to shut down your business. So my client actually distributed those Triton trailers for 7 months.
Did Triton say why they were severing the relationship?
No. They said, we're exercising our right. We don't want to have you sell our trailers anymore. And ultimately what happened is Mr. Seal's daughter and her husband started selling the Triton trailers.
So we don't know whether it was a management decision by Triton, independent of the alleged tortious conduct, or whether that instituted it. That's just something we have to guess at.
That's right. In the record, there's the letter from Triton to my client terminating his franchise, and it gives no reason for it.
Well, again, I mean, you made these arguments to the jury, correct?
Yes. But we also made them to the trial judge before she submitted the case to the jury, and you've got to have some evidentiary basis on causation. If you look also at the existence of the security agreement and these alleged rights in the Triton franchise, CIT had the priority in that. So CIT needed to be paid $262,000 before the SEALs were going to get paid. This case was a sale between the SEALs and Frank was Blue Sky. It was a nearly $1 million sale with $120,000 in hard assets at best. And the plaintiffs took back a $300,000 promissory note and agreed to a standby creditor agreement where they agreed they would not get paid until CIT did, that if there was a default, CIT would get paid first. I just don't think there's any showing of cause of how Frank could have paid CIT and the SEALs back had my client not come in and sold these trailers for 7 months. There's no evidence. On the civil conspiracy claim, as a matter of law, South Dakota law requires that there be two or more people capable of conspiring to breach a contract. The Landstrom case also says that you can't conspire to breach your own contract. So here, the alleged conspirators are Frank and his brother, my client, Jim. Well, Frank can't conspire to breach his own contract. So that just leaves one conspirator out there. If you don't have two or more people capable of conspiring, you can't have a civil conspiracy. And therefore, I believe that the trial court erred in submitting the civil conspiracy claim to the jury because there was no showing of two or more people capable of conspiring with the contract.
You know, this case is here on an appeal from a renewed motion for judgment as a matter of law, and I didn't see where you raised this civil conspiracy issue on the motion for judgment as a matter of law.
I believe it was raised at least when the initial motion was made to the trial court, and I thought it was made post trial as well. But
I didn't think it was made during the trial. It was made after the trial when you made your renewed motion. But I didn't see it having been raised to the trial court when the initial motion for judgment as a matter of law was made.
And I don't have, that may be correct. I know it was raised on a motion for summary judgment before the trial, and it was certainly, I guess, raised in the renewed motion. I want to touch on the jury award of damages for the civil conspiracy as well. The damage, if there is a civil conspiracy, the damage the plaintiff is entitled to is the damage approximately caused by the civil conspiracy. Here, though, the jury just put in the prejudgment interest amount claimed by the plaintiff as the civil conspiracy damages. I don't see how you can argue that the SEALs suffered prejudgment interest damages as approximate cause of the civil conspiracy. That doesn't make any sense. And I think the jury palpably mistook the instructions on damages by just plugging in that prejudgment interest number as a damage award for civil conspiracy.
The jury was instructed, though, that they could award prejudgment interest.
Yes.
And as I saw it, I didn't see a blank in the verdict form any place where they could insert an interest figure.
No, there wasn't.
So what were they to do? Maybe that's what they were doing.
Well, then that's a problem with the verdict form for the plaintiff. You know, we submitted the form where we wanted two separate awards, one for on the tortious interference case and one on the civil conspiracy case. If the plaintiff had wanted a separate blank in there for prejudgment interest, they should have asked for it. Finally, just briefly, the punitive damages award, we again disagree that there is clear and convincing evidence of a reasonable basis to conclude that my client acted maliciously, willfully, or wantonly. And I just go back to Mr. Molstead's testimony on what my client was doing, why he was doing it, and the legal advice that he got. I think based on Mr. Molstead's testimony alone, there was no basis to submit a punitive damages claim to the jury. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Woodward. Mr. Eklund, you have 20 minutes, sir.
Justices, I'm here this morning representing Jim Seal, who elected to attend this session, so he's here, and answer any questions you have about this. I see several areas you have interest in, but, you know, the evidence that was presented to the jury on this thing from the defense side was anything but consistent. And quite frankly, Jim Tozer and his brother Frank came off looking to this jury exactly like what they were, a couple of crooks. Jim Tozer loaned his brother $200,000, which was unknown to my clients at the time this contract was entered into. He professed on one occasion that he didn't know what the money was to be used for, but on other occasions he recognized that it was used by his brother to start this company. When we got into it, we found out that he knew a lot more about this company than he let on at times. He had check writing authority for Dakota Pacific Industries. He delivered products for them. In fact, he prepared the payment schedule for the original contract. This is a fellow that has some computer expertise. He's a nuclear engineer, believe it or not. But, you know, the other thing I think that came through to the jury on this, as some you've picked up on, is there were a lot of little inconsistencies in this thing with this being a so-called arm's length transaction. First of all, what two parties go to the same lawyer within 4 days after he missed his first payment? They create Aspen Industries down in Iowa. It was at that point a shell company. Later on, another company called Wolverine Properties built a building down there, which was transferred to Aspen, and then the building was leased to Dakota Pacific Industries Incorporated. You know, when you look at the exhibits and the invoices that we looked at and the jury had in front of them, Frank Tozer never stopped operating this company. Almost every invoice had the initials FT on it. You can look at Exhibit 20. Frank Tozer was the one, while Aspen Industries was supposedly the owner of this company, that gave discounts to customers, that negotiated deals, that in fact, on Exhibit 21, there's a fax to one of the customers where they gave a discount to a customer of Aspen Industries based on money that was owed to Dakota Pacific. That is a bait stamp number 71 in Exhibit 21. It's to Mike and Carol at Performance Sports. And here's what it says. I would also like to offer an additional amount to help compensate for the mess it caused because they sent out trailers early. Our records indicate that $1,474.96 is still owed to your prior account with Dakota Pacific. I will agree to credit an additional $274 to that account. Now, does that sound like an arm's length transaction, that they're given credit for something owed to Dakota Pacific on an account owed to Aspen Industries? And this is shows it's from Frank Tozer. You know, the greeting that you mentioned, the phone greeting, Exhibit 12, where they say, Frank and the staff and the entire staff are now working for Aspen Industries. Excuse me. When we took deposition, you know, and even at trial, they maintained Frank wasn't even an employee of this company. How do you suppose that looked to the jury? And then you have Jim Seal, who had started this company from nothing, and when the year they sold it, it had over $3 million in sales, and they paid tax on net profits of $300,000.
How do you address the counsel's argument about the causation here for damages, you know, that but for the transfer of these assets, your client would have been paid?
Well, this is a tort action, and I think the jury had the evidence in front of it. This was a $1 million sale. They had paid on this for 4 years, at least that, and yet this company is valueless. You know, we had the bankruptcy records also of Frank Tozer's bankruptcy that showed that he had built quite a valuable house in Omaha that he apparently ended up losing in the bankruptcy also. Now, where did that money go? You know, Jim Tozer acknowledged that he knew that the Triton business was the most valuable part of the company, and that's why they focused on that. I think I set that forth and probably even highlighted it in the brief. Jim Seal's testimony was that the Triton business was 75% of the sales that they made. Now, I think a jury, even in Gregory County, is capable of making those calculations and showing that this was a valuable asset and probably far in excess of any money that was owed to these creditors that was just destroyed.
Well, they only lost it for 7 months.
What's that?
They only lost the Triton franchise for 7 months, it sounds like.
You know, I think that's right. I don't think that counts against Jim Tozer because Jim Seal, because Jim Tozer was unable to maintain relationships with this company. They traveled there and met with them personally and convinced them to transfer this franchise from Dakota Pacific Industries to Aspen. Knowing full well that it was the subject of security agreements. And, you know, that's another subject I'd like to address. While they put a lot of stock in what Mr. Molstad advised their client, he also testified at trial that Jim and Rosemary Seal had a secured interest in those franchises. He looked at Exhibit 28 and said, yeah, they've got a secured interest in that. And this court has been through those battles on numerous occasions with liquor licenses and other franchises, and the SEALs have a secured interest in that. There was no shortage of evidence to show that that the SEALs had been damaged here. The evidence clearly showed that's what this entire exercise seems to be about, that the jury didn't have the evidence. Well, they certainly did. How can you say that those franchises or the company, the assets, were not interfered with by Jim Tozer when there's no evidence he paid a dime? They didn't introduce a single check or anything showing that Jim Tozer paid Dakota Pacific or Frank Tozer for any of those assets or anybody else. And yet, 4 years earlier, they were worth $1 million.
Well, I thought he bought the assets from a third party for $2,600 or something like that.
I think that if you look at that, that was well after this exercise was pretty well down the drain. They had some sort of a sale under Iowa law down there, and I don't even know what those assets were. They're itemized in there. I can't tell you. What I'm saying is I can't tell you off the top of my head, but it was a forklift and some odd parts and things like that. When Aspen was running this, they didn't even print their own business forms. They just got some little stickies and put on the Dakota Pacific business form. It still has their phone number. They used the DOT number to transport these things that had been obtained by Dakota Pacific. Same employees, same trucks. And here again, there isn't one bit of evidence showing that Jim Tozer paid a dime to anybody for any of that stuff.
Did you ask him at the trial if he had any documentation of any payments?
I don't recall that.
Okay.
I just don't recall that. But, and this concept that they come up with that, well, this can't be a civil conspiracy because you can't conspire against your own contract. Well, Jim Tozer was not a party to that contract. Frank was, but it's certainly possible for the two of them, and they did conspire. And what this court said in the Landstrom case and in the, I can't remember what the other case was. It was where the board of director, Nelson versus some water district, says if the case distilled to its essence involves only the parties to the contract, then you can't have but a civil conspiracy. But here, Jim Tozer was never, ever a party to this contract, although he was certainly involved in its formation because he printed the amortization schedule for it and certainly knew what was secured and what wasn't. And how you can look at those facts, I think we've got the cases and the statutes on the badges of fraud. In this case, during the time this Aspen Industries was in operation, you look at the exhibits in the file, Frank Tozer never quit managing this company. Jim Tozer never started, other than the participation that he had in attempting to short-circuit the creditors. And if he doesn't have legal liability for that, then we've started quite a new Wild West program in South Dakota on how you can cheat your creditors and get away with it. And this, I think, really offended the jurors, and it offended everybody else that was entitled to get paid. And I don't think you can justify that by saying, well, we both went to the same attorney, and he said it was fair game. If we can do that, then I can walk down the street and go into May Adam with my shotgun and say, hey, can I go in and withdraw money out of Bank West? And later say, well, the lawyer told me it was okay. That isn't any kind of an argument.
Mr. Eklund, there was a prior security interest with CIT in $262,000, was there not?
Excuse me.
Wasn't there a $262,000 prior security interest with CIT?
There was.
How does that affect damages then for your client? Was there a showing that the business was worth more than that $262,000? The evidence was there was $1 million sale, but $100,000 in hard assets, and the rest of it was blue sky.
Well, there was certainly historical evidence, income tax returns for this company that showed that it was making $300,000 per year or net profit. The other thing, by the time we tried this case, and one of their arguments to the jury was, the 2008 economy was terrible and things like that. But the fact of the matter was that during the time they were driving this thing into the ground, the economy was booming through 2004, 2005, 2006, and then in 2007, things started to go haywire. But when they went in to see Mr. Molstad after missing their payment in September of 2004, the United States economy was tripping along pretty good.
All right. On the damages, was this a general verdict for him?
Yes. That,
so there was speculation on this $46,000 in interest as being a significant factor, but how did we don't know where they came up with the damages then?
You can, if you want to go back and retry the case and do what the law says you can't do as far as examining the jury's process and arriving at the verdict, then I guess you can speculate on almost anything. They didn't submit a different instruction on this. One of the judges mentioned the unusual aspect of the judge's summarizing of the evidence in the instructions. As I recall, and Ms. Woodward didn't try the case, but as I recall, that summary came from the defense and was adopted by the court. And was certainly not objected to. So, unless you have some questions.
If you've completed your presentation, I guess you're done.
Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Eklund.
Thank you.
Ms. Woodward, you have 10 minutes.
Thank you, Your Honor. I don't have very much unless the court has some questions for me. One thing I did want to touch on, Justice Severson, I don't think this was a general verdict form. The jury was specifically asked to submit a damage measure, an amount of damages on the tortious interference claim, and an amount of damages on the civil conspiracy claim, and an amount of damages on the punitive damages claim. So we know that the jury awarded $104,371.37 for tortious interference, $46,220.67 for civil conspiracy, and punitive damages of $30,000. So to that extent, we do know what the jury was awarding in the damages. It happens that the jury's award coincides exactly with the seal's accountant's testimony regarding the principal owed on the note, which was what the jury awarded for tortious interference, prejudgment, or the interest owed on the note, which is what the jury awarded for civil conspiracy. which as I've testified to or have argued, doesn't make any sense as far as that being a measure of damages for a civil conspiracy. And then go back to the civil conspiracy case quickly. Civil conspiracy requires two people capable of conspiring to breach a contract. Now, I agree that Jim Tozier is one person capable of conspiring to breach Frank's contract with the SEALs. However, there's never been the showing of a second person capable of conspiring to breaching that contract. Frank isn't capable. If there was a third party named Bob, Bob and Jim could conspire to breach Frank's contract with the SEALs, but Frank and Jim can't conspire under the Landstrom cases, under Setliff, because there's not two or more people capable of conspiring to breach a contract. What you have here is a one-person conspiracy. And finally, as far as the argument that there's no evidence that my client paid a dime for anything, it's all over the record. My client testified about it. Frank Tozier testified about it. Don Molstead testified about it. My client bought the equipment from a third party after CIT foreclosed on its priority security interest. That's undisputed. He bought the equipment from a third party. He paid for it. You know, that's not looting. That's an arm's length transaction.
It was only $2,500,
wasn't it? No, it was more than that. It was, I think, $36,000, if I remember correctly. That's what the Mr. Molstead testified it appraised out at when Frank was going bankrupt. If the court doesn't have any other questions.
I guess you're done. Thank you much. Since we're on the Internet, we run on the hour, so we'll be in recess until 10 o'clock.